Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
And it's time now for the Friday Gathering, and I'm joined in the studio this week by Paul McCall of Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin North West, David Cullinan, Sinn Féin TD for Waterford and spokesperson on health. Michelle Murphy, Research and Policy Analyst at Social Justice Ireland is here, and Brenda Power, columnist with the Sunday Times and the Irish Daily Mail. You're all very welcome. Thank you for coming in today. I'm going to start with that column, Brenda, that you have open in front of you that you wrote because for the Daily Mail, you go for Sinn Féin in that column. You accuse them of being responsible for landlords leaving the rental market. And then you point the finger at the government. You say that they didn't stand up to them. So just explain the case that you outlined there.
Yeah, I mean, I went back to an interview that Ona Brin did in 2019, at which time there were 700 properties to rent in Dublin, which probably wasn't enough to satisfy
according to DAF
at the time, according to DAF.ie, yes. And his attitude at the time, and it was not just Sinn Féin, in fairness, it was pretty much a widespread I suppose, impression at the time, that the problem really was landlords, and landlords were the villains of the piece, and landlords had to be reined in. Landlords were greedy, they were avaricious, they were imposing dreadful conditions on people, and that once you got the landlords brought to heel, that you would solve the housing crisis. And Ona Brin at the time suggested, among other things, that landlords should be prevented, for instance, from selling their own properties if they had sitting tenants, that they should be prevented from evicting sitting tenants, again, to put in their own family members. And basically that once you sort of crack down on landlords, that the rest would fall into place. I remember writing at the time, that is just so wrong, because the people you need to keep in the market are the small landlords, the kind of what they call mom and pop landlords, people who may have downsized from a family home or may have inherited a house and have decided, or maybe have bought and said, look, this will be my retirement income.
And do you really think that because Owen O'Brien said that should happen, that the small landlord said, oh, now I'm going to sell that house because Owen O'Brien said that I might be prevented from selling it at some point?
You're listening to Owen O'Brien and then you're looking at the polls in which Sinn Féin is performing very favourably. And if you were ever thinking of selling that property, I certainly, if it was me, I would sell it now. Mm-hmm. And I think that is borne out by the fact that now across the country, there are 700 houses to rent.
David, what do you say to that?
It's absolute rubbish. I mean, the notion that, first of all, Sinn Féin is in any way responsible for the housing crisis or the rental crisis is just laughable, to be honest. The first thing is, what we want is security of tenure for tenants. And obviously, that's a really important part of any housing strategy. I'm not anti-landlord, and there are many, many fine landlords who provide an excellent service. And we need private landlords and we need a private rental sector. Obviously, it has to be regulated. And obviously, you know, we also have to put in place protections for renters. And what we've been actually calling for is a bolstering of housing supply, because the real problem at the moment is the vast majority of people who have a housing need, whether it's student accommodation, whether it's people who are in need of social and affordable housing, or people who just want to rent. Everybody's been forced into the private rental sector. HAP, RAS, all of those options are all sourced from the private sector. We don't have the supply, and that's putting huge pressure on the system.
But you can't deny that Owen O'Brien said that in 2019, that landlords should be prevented from selling their properties.
What we want is a fair policy that provides security for tenants, because you can't have a situation where tenants can just simply be asked to leave at the drop of a hat. At the moment, there are rules in place already. I think those rules can be strengthened. But at the end of the day,
you don't think that landlords should be banned from selling their properties?
Well, I think in some circumstances, there should be a time limit, certainly on when landlords can sell and how they can do it. What we've been talking about and what Owen was talking about as part of a wider policy was that we want proper security of tenure for tenants. I think that's reasonable.
Can you see how that would put people off renting out properties?
No, because if you're renting out properties, What Brenda is talking about is not renting out the properties, getting out of it to give it maybe to family members and so on. So if you're going to go into a contract for a time period, it has to be for a reasonable period of time, because when families move into a house, they obviously want to have some security. Most of them will invest in the houses. Mm-hmm. They'll make improvements in the houses that they're in. And we have a lot of mobility where people are obviously getting notice to quit. and very short notice, and that can put real pressure on families. So there is the point is there is a place for the private rental sector, but there has to be security of tenure, as I said, for tenants. And the real solution is to bolster supply.
David, I just wanted to ask then, why do you think that landlords, private landlords, have been getting out of the rental market at five times the rate they're coming into it? You know, I do not accept for a second that any landlord who has perhaps invested their life savings or taken out a mortgage in order to have an investment income for their old age wants to evict tenants at the drop of a hat, as you say. In my experience, the few people I know who are private renters, all they want is someone who will come in there, who will behave themselves, who will look after the property and who will pay their
rent.
But
Brenda, you might have noticed as well, house prices have shot up in a dramatic way over the last number of years. Many landlords are deciding to sell, and that's what happens because they can see a rise in prices. It's a good time to sell. It's a good time to get out. So there's a whole host of reasons why some landlords would get out. But the notion that you're peddling that this is something to do with Owen O'Brien or something to do with Sinn Féin, I accept that there are good landlords. There are also some poor landlords as well, Brenda, which have been well documented.
There are also poor tenants.
Absolutely.
And I would accept that. That, for instance, if somebody is, you mentioned HAP, I mean that if the tenant does not pay their share of the HAP, the landlord gets nothing that month. You know, so landlords, a lot of the provisions that have been put in there around rental benefit the tenants more than they do the landlords.
Well, what I can say very clearly is that Owen O'Brien
You can't lay that at Sinn Féin.
No, but I'm just saying that you know, again, the demonisation of landlords has led to this narrative.
But it's not a demonisation. Can I just make one very quick point? Owen O'Brien has engaged with the representative groups of landlords and has had very good engagement with them. And they recognise that what we need is sustainability in terms of the private rental sector. They also know that there are wider issues in relation to housing supply that need to be dealt with. But I don't believe there's any landlords out there that are blaming Sinn Féin or blaming Owen O'Brien for the housing crisis. I think that's just outrageous. It's a political statement, in my view, and it just doesn't bear up. The reality is we haven't been in government. We want to be in government. And if we are, we will bring sustainability to the private rental sector, and there is a place for that.
This is a comfortable place for you to be, where Brenda is blaming Sinn Féin for the housing crisis. But, I mean, she also says in her piece today that the government is too scared to stand up to Sinn Féin when it comes to demonising landlords.
Actually, it's funny you said that it's a comfortable place. I often think that when a lot of people talk about the identity of Fianna Fáil and what we stand for, we suffer in this kind of new black and white politics where one sector of society demonises the other, and people forget to talk about the society that we live in, the village, that they have to be a shopkeeper and a shop worker in every village. And so on housing specifically, I believe, look, we know what the issues are. We know very specifically it is as a result of 10 years of undersupply, but it's not just about any supply, it's about embedding affordable supply into the market. That's what the Housing for All plan does. It's very significant budget that has been budgeted for on a multi-annual basis. The legislation has brought in new models of affordable purchase, affordable rental.
Is actually getting worse, Paul.
Of course it is, Claire, because you can't reverse 10 years of undersupply in the space of 24 months. But this government will be judged by that.
So it's your partners in government then who are to blame.
Well, David, actually, you very often paint a picture that, you know, this is just a continuation of the same government for 100 years. And any either historian or current affairs spokesperson knows that's just not true. Fianna Fáil were out of power for 10 years. On our return, we introduced restrictions on what people can do with public land. We were introduced restrictions on what can be done in private land. We've lent into the public sector delivering on housing. That is what Fianna Fáil believe in. We believe that that's where the solution is. And to be fair, I think too often in the housing debate, we focus in on one tiny issue and we believe that that's the solution. Like, Brenda just isn't. I don't believe she's being fair when she talks about people leaving the market purely because we're giving tenants more rights. Of course, we should give tenants more rights. Why would we not give tenants?
It's also driven by the fact that people have been threatened with the possibility that they may not be able to deal with their own private property if Sinn Féin come to power.
And that is one of the reasons why we need to have a constitution amendment on the right to housing, and why we need to bring that forward. But the only reason people can leave the market as landlords is if they're significantly upgrading it, if there's a family member moving in, or if they're selling it.
What constitutional amendment are you proposing, by the way?
Well, I'll come back to that in a second, but you're talking about people leaving the market. So people are only leaving the market under those circumstances. We have capped the rate of rent increases below the rate of inflation, right? Sinn Féin want to freeze it completely, which would permanently embed a loss for landlords. We're saying it's capped at 2%. All of this conversation demonstrates that there is a balance in all of these. Unfortunately, we too often get black and white.
Do you know that point that David made earlier on, that prices have gone up. Your rent that you're taking in if you're a small landlord is capped now in many
That's
places.
Right, yeah.
So it is more attractive, isn't it, to sell the house? Because you're paying the higher rate of tax in most cases
on
what you're bringing in.
And as we talk about maybe further tax incentives for landlords, we'd have to think about whether that actually will increase supply or maintain supply. For example, people could be working out debt that they built up over the crash 10 years ago. People can decide to leave the market because they are retiring and because they're leaving. There's a whole
Do you think
range
a bit of tax back is going to make it attractive
no,
enough for people to stay in?
I'm not certain that alone is the factor. And I do want to see us move towards us having a stable, affordable rental market. Like we talk about Vienna and Berlin and all of those places. The legislation is now on the books for cost rental. What we need are the AHBs and the councils.
Michelle,
to start
here. We haven't
this.
Heard from you yet, yeah, Michelle. Well, you're sitting there listening to all of this. And this is the week where Simon Harris has asked people to open up their houses to students.
And I mean, this time last year, we were listening about the student housing crisis, but it's not just 10 years of undersupply. It's 2 to 3 decades of decision that a house is now a commodity. It gets you on the wealth ladder. You're on the housing ladder. It's not a home. And so now we find ourselves in a situation, and everybody saw the photograph during the week of those hundreds of people queuing to look at a property. But the discussion here doesn't actually deal with, like, how do you increase supply? We're looking at a budget coming up. We have housing for all. What you actually need to do is double the targets in housing for all. Set yourself a target that you have 20% of your housing stock as social housing by 2030. You would free up 60,000 properties in the private rental market then. Think of what that would do in terms of reducing rents for people in the private rental market who, if you take into the cost of housing, have a very high rate of poverty.
But Michelle, what's the point in setting a target that's not achievable?
But it is achievable.
But it's clearly not.
How is it not achievable?
Housing for all sets really, really ambitious targets. There are people
it doesn't, because the social housing target, the second half of that target, they don't even detail how it's going to be met.
But
funding is going to come from.
Housing isn't just about social housing. It's about
all
about
housing. But your crisis has been in social housing for more than a decade. You are relying on the private rental market to provide social housing solutions which do not work. Those people are in very precarious rental situations. The actual real social housing numbers, if you take into account people number on HAP and RAS, who are in very precarious situations, is about 133,000 people. What are you going to do to support those households?
Do you accept we've made a policy decision with legislation and with money to move away from that towards an affordable rent?
We are saying you need to increase your social housing supply to deliver on a cost rental model.
And do you accept we're delivering social housing?
Not at the rate that you need to be delivering it.
If you put yourself in the shoes of the people who are victims of the housing crisis, the vast majority of them want to own their own house and they can't afford to do it because of very high prices at the moment. They're stuck in paying really high rents or living with their parents. For people who want a social house or an affordable house, we simply are not building enough. So to say that we have to be ambitious, of course we do, and we have to be realistic as well. We have said for years, and it's been something that others have said, ESRI and many others, we need to build 20,000 social and affordable homes, 12,000 social homes, 8,000 affordable, which would include 4,000 cost rental and 4,000 affordable. That would reduce pressure on the private rented sector because everybody is in the same space at the moment. Mm-hmm. And that's driving up the
prices. Is that
what
the government is trying to do?
But it's not achieving its target. So even the government's target of 9,000 social houses, it's going to meet about half of that this year. So it's falling behind almost all of the targets it set. And as Michelle said, the targets are not ambitious enough.
You also have to look at the other numbers, commencements and completion.
I'm going to leave that one there because I want to move on to
house price,
all right,
prices.
We've got our budget coming up next month in a change to normal practice, and a lot of talk this week about tension, Paul, amongst the coalition partners when it comes to what should happen with social welfare, in particular job seekers allowance. Is there tension there as to whether there should be an increase or not?
Well, look, it's probably the first budget that this coalition will deal with that isn't dominated by COVID, and I think that's really that's a good place for each of the political parties to, because budgets are about priorities. I've listened to all of August where there's different parties kind of kite flying, but ultimately Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue have to sit down and put together a budget that is going to address the issues for everyone in society. And there is political parties. I see Sinn Féin talking about a figure of €50, a long-term figure, albeit. And I see Fine Gael talking about a new rate of tax. But that's pitching to the base. The budget has to be put together for the whole country. And it goes back to that
and
team of
what are you
of our,
saying?
Well, look, what I... big issue that was raised at the pre-summer budget consultation which Michael McGrath and Micheál Martin had with the Fianna Fáil backbench was the issue of childcare. I want to make sure that the issue of childcare is addressed. And I think that's one example of where public services that where we have kind of greater public involvement in services that people provide can help reduce the cost of living. Of course, if we give people increases, and we do need to give people increases, particularly across the board in social welfare, I think this idea of certain categories of social welfare being excluded is ridiculous and doesn't address the issues.
What should that be? €15? That's what the Greens say.
Look, I'm not gonna jump at a figure here, right? It's before a budget. That's with the minister. It has to at least reach the rate of inflation. I'd love for it to have been done in consultation with or in conjunction with a national wage agreement, that we have all of the partners together and that we address these issues in the same way as we did in the year.
So
in
you've
the
no
late
opinion
80s.
On what it should be. It should just be something.
No, that's not true. Now, what I'm saying is the rate of inflation is at 10%. In my view, we have to be looking in that area. But we could help people
so
by
basic job seekers.
Claire, the second half of the sentence
that's
is
20.
Claire, the second half of the sentence is if other measures are taken that reduce people's costs, that can be dealt with in conjunction. And that's what we need to be looking at. When we reduce travel costs for buses, when we reduce hospital charges earlier in the year, those things put money in people's pockets. So those sort of we can deliver what's in the programme for government, deliver better public services at a lower cost, and
Brenda,
that can help the cost of living too.
What do you say about this debate that we've been having over the last number of weeks when it comes to social welfare, in particular job seekers allowance?
It should never be controversial, Claire, to say that not working ought to be an option. And I noticed it was Marco Cozzi in with you yesterday, and he said we should make sure that work pays for people. In other words, that it is worth people's while to work. I have a problem with that attitude, with that narrative, that if it doesn't pay you better than to take a lowly paid job, that you should sit on your backside with your hand out. I do not accept that.
And you really think that an increase in
I don't
job
believe 15 euro is sufficient to make anybody who wants to work not work. At the same time, in my view, where any spare benefit that is available should be fueled is towards people in low paid employment.
Okay, Michelle.
To keep people to make Michelle. It because can I just finish that I don't think that work should simply be viewed as a transactional process, that there is much more to working. It's about self-esteem, it's about mental health, it's about setting good example for your children. It's not just about pounds, shillings and pence.
Michelle.
Okay. 20 euros a week is the minimum we're looking for, and that social welfare rates be benchmarked to average earnings. That's where you need to go. This is an income adequacy crisis that has been going on for more than a decade for people on fixed incomes. So that's family carers, people who are unemployed, people with a disability, pensioners, older people living alone, lone parents. Because social welfare rates aren't benchmarked against anything, neither inflation nor wages. So for a start, we're looking for 20 euros a week and a commitment to benchmark against average wages. That is where we need to go.
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask you specifically about the disincentive to work argument.
There is no disincentive to work, Claire. All of the data says from ourselves, from the ESRI, that the replacement rates in this country are not high except for a very particular cohort of people who might be in danger. Generally, it's families in danger of losing a medical card. And it's up to government and the department to work out how you prevent a cliff edge for people. Everybody else, all the data says, and we have shown it, is that you are better off in employment. And if you look at the statistics at the moment, we're more or less in full employment. We have an unemployment rate of about 4%, which is considered full employment. So you have to look at that cohort. What is the rate of long-term unemployment there? What sort of supports do they need? Because I agree with Brenda, there's more to employment than just the income. It's your contribution to the community, the other social and economic benefits that you get from that. But to demonise a cohort of people and say that they're unwilling to get out when we have inflation running at 10% and that you think that it's adequate for people to live on 208 euros a week when our own parliamentary budget office showed that last year the real value of that was actually 193 euros a week before we hit an almost 10% rate of inflation.
David, bring you in here because Paul mentioned the €50 a week which has been attributed to Sinn Féin as what you were calling for. I know Pascal Donoghue the week before last mentioned it as well. You've pushed back against that. You say that you didn't suggest that.
I'm glad you have raised this because it was covered on Drive Time yesterday and it was inaccurate, and Paul is inaccurate, although he did qualify it at the end. We have not said that there should be an immediate €50 increase in social welfare
payments.
What we were talking about is the minimum essential standard of living, which has been set by the Vincentian Partnership, which sets out what the level should be to at least have them just above the poverty line, and that would be a €48 a week increase. What we have said is that that would have to be done over a term in government over 5 years. And the first thing we have to do is to set up an adequacy commission that would actually look at more targeted measures, because there's different rates of welfare payments.
So you're looking at a tenner a year. So is it €10 this year as well, you think?
And we will set that out in an alternative budget. We will launch it in a couple of weeks' time. We obviously are working on our budget at the moment and we will launch that. It won't be €50 or anywhere near it, but it obviously has to be significant to ensure that those people on welfare are supported. And by the way, the vast majority of people want to work. The vast, vast majority of people. If they get a job, they will take a job. A lot of people who are in receipt of welfare are carers, people in disability payments, and they should not be stigmatised. We have to make sure that people have an adequate standard of living. And that's what we were calling for.
We were not calling for.
So just so we're very crystal clear, we were not calling for a €50.
Yeah, but social welfare is the floor, Claire. So if there was a decision, or people are advocating that other social welfare payments should be increased, and job seekers, including job seekers for those people who are newly unemployed, should not be increased, then they're effectively calling for a reduction for those people who've lost their jobs.
I just want to touch on Minister Robert Troy, and this week he issued a full explanation and an apology yesterday, because he said that he misunderstood the rules when it came to what he should disclose to standards in public office. Now, when someone says that they misunderstand the rules, Paul, do the rules matter so little to you and your colleagues that you then say that's grand and we all move on? You know, he was called top class by the Taoiseach this week.
Look, I think Robert's apology is very fulsome. I think he explains what his position was, and he has fully disclosed all of the interests that he has.
You know, he was on the programme though a week ago, and he was asked to explain all of this, and it took him a full week to get to the point yesterday when he did.
No, and he has made that full.
But are the rules that hard to understand?
No, and like it's clear from Robert that he was of the assumption that the declaration was made at the time when he made the declaration that he included his interests.
He was wrong on that,
and he has apologised onto it. Like we do have to look at how what interests politicians have, because it's important that the public know that when we make decisions, that we're making them for the right reasons and what interests we have in terms of making those decisions. So it is fully right. And if we've established the Electoral Commission just before the summer, it doesn't include SIPO, but there will have to be work with them together. If further changes need to be made, particularly, for example, around the sale to a local authority as opposed to a contract with a local authority, then I have no issues with any of those changes being made.
One of the issues that he had to correct, David, was the fact that he didn't include his job as director of a property company in his register at the time when he was filling that in. Do you think Robert Troy can continue in his role as company regulation minister, given that that happened?
I'm not going to call for any heads on this programme, that's for sure. What I will say is that the drip feed of information over the last number of weeks from Robert was unacceptable. We had a statement yesterday. I don't believe we still have all of the information.
No, but he's been commended all over the place for correcting
commended.
The record.
He has not been commended by me or my party. He's been commended by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael leaders. That's a matter for them. Mm-hmm. I believe that was wrong. I believe there are still questions to be answered in relation to the sale of the property to the local authority, because it was sold, we understand, a 100% profit within 6 months. What improvements were made to the house within that time period, if any? And the bottom line is, I don't want, and I will not be a TD that profits from the housing crisis. That's for sure. I don't think that's a position that a TD should put themselves in.
Okay. Anyone else want to comment on that?
I don't think. I read a recent article which suggested that up to a half of our TDs are millionaires. I don't know if any of them are in the studio.
I was one of them, apparently, Brenda. And do you know how they calculated it? They included the future pension that I might get if I served for the full for the full term, which is ridiculous. And the pension pot you would be required. That was a ridiculous article, and I think David would agree that it was based on very little.
So you were both in it then.
Yeah, exactly. And there's TDs with no interest outside of just being a TD that were regarded as being millionaires.
Well, I just think that, sorry, Brendan, you know, this is a government minister who has a parliamentary assistant, has a someone running his constituency office. He's a minister. He clearly has staff. And has been in government, has been elected, you know, he's not just a newly elected TD. I mean, what is so challenging about the SIPO handbook? For example, members of the community voluntary sector or charity organisations, you have to comply with the Charity Regulatory Authority every year. You have to fill in the lobbying register every quarter. And if you don't fill it in correctly, they're back onto you pretty quickly to let you know.
And I'm sure people make mistakes in that sector too, and they have to correct it. The question around this, though, and it's raised in letters to the papers today, you know, what are the rules there for if nothing happens, if you break them? Nothing happens.
No obligation on Robert Troy and anybody else who may now be cowering from the next headline that exposes their own interests to inform themselves of what they are meant, what their obligations are when they take a public
All right, I have to leave that there. Thank you very much for coming in, David Cullinan, Michelle Murphy, Brenda Power and Paul McAuliffe. That's all we have time for today and for this week. Thank you very much for listening. Today's programme was produced by the series producer Alistair McConnell, research by Adriana Rona. Our broadcast coordinator is Sean Marram and Cara O'Hare was on sound. Now, it's just coming up to 12 midday and for the last time this week, we head over to Ronan Collins.